Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Michael Scott, and I am the head of the Anthropology Department here at the LSE. It's my great pleasure to introduce this inaugural lecture, part of a school-wide series of recognizing our faculty who have recently been promoted or appointed to full professorship. These lectures mark a significant milestone in an academic's career and afford us the opportunity to highlight and enjoy the successes of our community. Tonight, we celebrate the promotion of our colleague, Hans Steinmuller, to Professor of Anthropology. And we're delighted to host family, friends, and colleagues who are with us here in person or online. On behalf of the LSE and the Department of Anthropology, I extend a warm welcome to all. Professor Steinmuller joined our faculty in 2010 as an assistant professor, shortly after completing his PhD, and has been a central figure in our department ever since. One of the most distinctive theorists in our discipline, he is in constructive dialogue not only with anthropologists, but also with archaeologists, historians, philosophers, and political theorists. His work is grounded in long-term field work, totaling some 3 years of participant observation in rural central China and in the Hua state of eastern Myanmar, one of the most complex and least studied political territories in Southeast Asia. Out of these two very different field sites, he has developed a body of work that speaks to some of the most fundamental questions in political anthropology. His first monograph, Communities of Complicity, along with a number of related publications, showed how people in rural China navigate the gap between official public discourse and the rich, ambiguous world of local practice, and theorized complicity as essential to everyday ethics and local politics. Professor Steinmuller's concept of everyday sovereignty, developed through his Myanmar fieldwork and introduced in a series of recent articles, reveals that power is never simply coercive. It is also nurturing and caring, two faces of the same relationship. Throughout, his work insists that people are not merely products of empire or state power, but are active and creative inventors of their own social worlds, and that the complexity of life at the margins is always infinitely richer than the labels imposed from the outside or above. This is anthropology at its best, attentive to the particular, but always in dialogue with the broadest questions of how human beings live together, exercise power, and find freedom to do things differently. Indeed, as a measure of the importance of his Myanmar research, Professor Steinmuller signed a contract just last weekend with the University of California Press for his second monograph, The Commander's Children, Capture and Care in the Hua State. His is a body of work, then, that is still gathering momentum. It is entirely fitting, therefore, that tonight he takes up precisely these themes in his inaugural lecture, Complexity and Complicity in Social Anthropology. Please join me in welcoming Professor Hans Steinmuller.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I haven't said. Anthropologists often ask for more complexity, as if that was a good thing. The word is usually invoked as a value rather than a concept. The more complexity, the better, it seems. Complicity, on the other hand, is generally understood to be negative. Many anthropologists have reflected on the complicity of the discipline in colonialism, for instance. So complexity is good, complicity is bad. But is it really that simple? If we step back and reflect on complexity and complicity in social anthropology, what can we say? Since I got interested in these topics, I started to read a little bit in complexity theory. Biologists Jack Cohen and mathematician Ian Stewart have written an introduction to this field, which is called The Collapse of Chaos. Cohen and Stewart distinguish two main branches of complexity theory. The first one identifies some rules that can give account of simple features at one level of analysis, while ignoring what might happen above and below. That's what they call simplexity. Don't worry, I'm not going to use that. But there are other processes where no simple rules ever work, and those processes they label complicity. Here is how Ian Stewart explains how their idea took shape. I first met Jack Cohen in 1990. He'd been reading my book, Does God Play Dice?, had some questions to ask me, and phoned to suggest we met to discuss them. One of the first questions that Jack asked me was, what do you call it when two separate systems kind of, at this point, he moved his hands in the air like someone climbing a rope, interact recursively with each other so that both are changed beyond recognition? I knew what he meant. Evolution is a good example, where the information in genes interacts with the global ecosystem to select organisms that work. But as far as I knew, there wasn't a name for such behavior. Now, in the book they wrote, the name they give to it is complicity. That movement of two systems that changes both, like two hands waving in the air and holding an invisible rope. They use complicity as a summary concept for attempts in complexity science to capture problems that escape mechanistic and deterministic frameworks. Processes where the connection between the elements is not direct, and it is impossible to identify direct causality, or one set of rules that explains what happens. Complexity means that the rules are evolving, and it is those shifting goalposts of explanation that complexity science describes with terms such as nonlinearity, emergence, self-organization. There are countless empirical examples that fit the bill. Actually, most social phenomena belong here. The founding purpose of this university is for the betterment of society, supported by its motto, to know the causes of things, or in Latin, rerum cognoscere causas. Here is a picture of what you can see at the entrance of this building. That's the motto of LSE. Now, that's a formidable task, not the least because most social scientists agree that social things do not have causes. Social interaction cannot be understood reductively in the sense that simple rules could explain it. All the core problems of social science and social anthropology are complex in this way. Just to give you a few random examples, why do some people follow conventions and others innovate? What happens when people care for each other? How does kinship make people, and how does agriculture produce grain? Creativity, care, and farming present irreducible complexity. That is, interactions between two systems that produce certain features, but where no element, no cause, no part, and no result can be expressed in simple terms and coherent rules. But of course, Humans have done exactly that. They have words for all these complexities. In the Wa language of Southeast Asia, for instance, people say dobre, and by that they mean to give food, but also to take care of someone. And doing so is the definitive act of what we call kinship. Actually, there's a lot of variety in local dialects of Wa, and even the most basic concepts are sometimes different from village to village, let alone the usual kinship addresses, the names of plants and spirits, the dress and songs, and the genealogies that elders can recite. These are the things that are commonly summarized as bun, the tradition, the custom of a village, such as bun marai. Now, while local bun is extremely diverse, today it's also accompanied by a new paranationalist culture that unites all the inhabitants of the so-called Wa state, a de facto state the size of Belgium in northeastern Myanmar. Local intellectuals and officials are actively involved in the creation of a nation state, of a nation state culture and a standard language. Established in 1989, the United Wa State Army has been involved in projects of modernization, such as road construction, an electricity grid, and the substitution of poppy fields for rubber plantations. In the villages, much land has been collectivized for tea plantations or appropriated by the army elites to create rice paddies and pine tree plantation. One day, some 7 years ago, I was sitting at the side of one such plantation in the making. The commander, Airai, had planted tea shrubs some 8 years earlier that hadn't grown. And so he ordered the villagers to plant dry rice instead. Now this year, it was 2017, he decided to try pine trees. And some 50 villagers had been working several days planting the seedlings in the midst of the rice. Having transplanted, so they're carrying pine tree seedlings. Having transplanted those trees for some time, I sat down with the children, and Aisang, the teenage son of my host, began to name all the different herbs and grasses growing there at the edge of the field. I could barely keep up recording the names, let alone remembering their shapes and properties, how they had to be dealt with and what they meant. That much was clear: the ethnobotany of those weeds was incomparably more difficult than that of the dry rice or the pine trees nearby. And the skills with which someone like Aisang could pick certain plants and do things with them, for instance, tie a knot of bamboo strings to stabilize a fence, those skills far exceeded the rather minimal skills required in the plantation. Aisang's skills are adapted to the specificity of local plants, but all this is not necessary in the plantation, where all the plants are the same. So compared to the diversity of the plants and the skills, the plantation is simple. The plantation is a modular simplification, in the words of Anat Singh, Andrew Matthews, and Niels Buband. Having the same plants growing in rows and lines all the same time makes them recognizable and readable from one central vantage point. In this way, the plantation creates state legibility, and it does so principally by erasing complex entanglements and replacing them with units of similar size and structure. But the plantation is only the most brutal form of simplification, and many other things similarly disentangle the social environment and reduce it to units of similar size. For instance, living in cities, division of labor, machine arrangements, basically all the features that are commonly used to distinguish complex societies from simple societies. So, so-called complex societies rely on powerful tools of simplification, whereas in so-called simple societies, social interaction remains complex. Starting from this counterfactual, that supposed complexity is based on simplification, I want to ask, what do we mean by complexity and simplicity in social anthropology? That includes both the definition of those terms as well as the processes of simplification and complexification. The first part of my lecture deals with these issues in theory And the second part relates them to empirical material that I learned about in central China and in the Hua Hills of the China-Burma border. So first, complexity in theory. Just after he completed his fieldwork on the Trobriand Islands in 1919, Bronislaw Malinowski imagined in his diaries a perfect being. A perfect being that would be able to record all regularities in social groupings and behavior by objective means of collecting data, including by kinematograph and phonograph. 3 years later, in the famous introduction of Argonauts of the Western Pacific, he's more modest. He outlined how anthropologists should collect data through fieldwork. Only long-term participant observation would allow the ethnographer access to the imponderabilia of everyday life, the unpredictable happenstance occurrences that could be only experienced by being in a place for a long time. Now, if the target is more modest here, namely to familiarize oneself with a place and arrive at a working understanding, likely Malinowski never dismissed the possibility of complete or near-complete understanding of all social action and individual behavior. At least the confidence with which he and his students explained the social, using terms such as structure and function, suggests this might have been a guiding assumption, that it was possible to identify simple rules of social action. This assumption, however, has been thoroughly demolished since, exactly at the time when computers came to be widely used, first in the military, then in industry, and eventually also by ordinary people. The theories that were developed together with computers, especially after the end of World War II, information theory, cybernetics, offered a radically different worldview. Rather than the reductive and determinist perspective of Newtonian mechanics, cybernetics tackled time irreversible and nonlinear processes, such as cloud behavior. One central objective was to identify shared principles across brains and computers, and thus go beyond the opposition of organism and machine. You might wonder, what's that got to do with anthropology? Now, at least in those days, one anthropologist was centrally involved. Gregory Bateson worked together with others on feedback mechanisms, oscillation, and schismogenesis. But then current theories of cybernetics were also central to many other anthropologists. Lévi-Strauss, for instance, often referred to cybernetics quite explicitly and suggested it could provide models for the comparative study of kinship. Edmund Leach, in his 1959 Malinowski lecture, uses the digital computer as a model for what anthropologists should do, that is, identify basic and simple principles of social action. On that basis, they could draw mathematical equations between the topologies of kinship, while insisting that all these were only analytical constructs and not actually existing structures out there in the real world. Feminist and Marxist anthropology further questioned the positivism of earlier anthropology. The more anthropologists began to theorize and propose radically different perspectives on the same empirical material, the more it became apparent that the rules of social action really were in the eye of the beholder. While the processing power of those theories grew just like those of computers, their object changed from the causes of things to general complexity. At the same time, the word complexity became a standard term, widely used not just by scientists, but also by the general public. When Marilyn Strathern began to write about relations and networks in the 1980s, anthropologists had accepted that the social is irreducibly complex, and relatedly came to ask for ever more reflexivity in empirical description. Strathern's work responds directly to this new environment. If anthropologists want to describe the complex linkages between elements, they can only simplify them. Doing so, they must pay attention to problems of context and scale, and they can only ever draw partial connections, which is the title of a collection of essays that Strathern published in 1991. Studying modern societies and bureaucracies, Bruno Latour began to criticize classical sociology in similar ways. The social mechanisms of science inevitably reduce the messiness of the world into fictitious essences, such as society, pure and simple. While working on actor network theory, Latour also got interested in primate sociology, where scholars such as Shirley Strum had drawn attention to the social complexity of baboons. Latour and Strum collaborated over several years, comparing the human social and the baboon social, and in a particularly ambitious article, they proposed a redefinition of the social link, Latour and Strum, 1987. The social doesn't exist in principle, but only in practice. In practice, social actors define society and perform society, and there's no difference between baboons and humans in that regard. They all perform society. But there are considerable differences in the tools and symbols available to each. Baboons, for instance, have only few, and thus their social lives are entangled in complexity, and they cannot mobilize large groups. Humans, who have tools and symbols, can simplify everyday interaction and easily connect across scale with larger collectives. The more tools and symbols become available in human societies, for instance, in an industrial society when compared to hunter-gatherers, the easier large networks are assembled. Now, these are important insights that, unfortunately, Latour never developed further, at least not in regard to the complexity of the non-modern. On the contrary, his late work is squarely situated in post-industrial society. In his own words, it's an anthropology of the moderns. Strathern's writings on context, scale, and fractality are more helpful for our purposes here. The true anthropologist, Strathern always remained grounded in the non-European and non-modern perspective that she had acquired during fieldwork in Papua New Guinea. Latour, on the contrary, never truly left his native France and is unable to take an outside, non-modern perspective. For instance, regarding the length and density of networks, Latour clearly distinguishes what he calls the modern from the pre-modern. While modern networks are long and wide and make excessive use of hybrids, Latour never engages with non-modern examples. In response, Marilyn Strathern points out that in Mount Hagen in PNG, for instance, the exchanges of kinship do indeed include very long networks and also a lot of hybridity. Latour inevitably returns to the assumption that there's something special that sets the moderns apart. This assumption is generally related to complexity, namely that modern society is complex, whereas traditional communities are simple. It's not just in everyday use, but still widely accepted in the social sciences and in archaeology, especially. Societies that have many members, that have many social roles, division of labor, centralized government, and lots of machines are complex societies. And they are distinguished from simple societies which have little or nothing of the same. Since the 1950s, anthropologists and archaeologists have tried to situate societies on evolutionary stages, such as band, tribe, state. But more recently, archaeologists have found many examples that are hard to locate on such timelines. For instance, there are monumental constructions of hunter-gatherers. There are relatively egalitarian proto-cities, such as Çatalhöyük in Turkey, in what is now Turkey. In their joint work, The Dawn of Everything, David Graeber and David Wengro discuss numerous such examples and point out that common narratives of progress and evolution make little sense. Not just that, the assumption that larger societies inevitably become more hierarchical and the expectation that human history moves from the simple to the complex cannot be substantiated. They are myths. Over many centuries and in many places, humans experimented with social forms, and such experimentation cannot be explained with frameworks that assume that complexity and hierarchy are tied to each other and inevitably increase throughout human history. Now, if the book signals a new engagement between anthropology and archaeology, debunking myths is perhaps not enough to tackle the challenges that complexity poses for social theory. The new archaeological data that Graeber and Wengro refer to provides countless hints for re-examining this concept and the concept of simplicity. Indeed, Wengro himself has written very interestingly about simplicity and, for instance, the contradictory side effects of urban life and political centralization in the Neolithic Near East. In a 2001 article, he points out that pottery as a science became increasingly less diverse at the same time when the first cities appeared. The tools of everyday consumption in those cities were relatively simple compared to what was there before. And this he calls an evolution of simplicity. The archaeologist of indigenous North America, Severin Fowles, reveals the rise of complexity in archaeology and calls for a comparative investigation into simplicity, which he argues usually evolves in creative opposition or as a double movement. Complexity and simplicity always come together. Norman Joffe goes even further and proposes that the core features of Mesopotamian state building, classical markers of social complexity such as political centralization and urbanism, that these are actually a form of social simplification that creates state legibility. Joffe's book directly applies the concept of James Scott, who had argued in Seeing Like the State, or he had focused on that concept of state legibility, by settling down, by establishing grid structures, by dividing populations into administrative units, such state legibility is created, which in turn makes it possible to see and to govern, manipulate populations. And this is essential to the purposes of statecraft, which are taxation, conscription, pacification. Of course, writing is the central and guiding metaphor here, but state legibility is by no means limited to writing. Agriculture, sedentism, the common family surname, all these things create readability, a recognizable pattern that enables governance. But more fundamentally, the script, the symbol, or the grid create radically different and simplified duplications of reality. A stroke in the list, for instance, the half end of a seal, those are specific markers that stand for something else, for instance, for a person. A script uses symbolic markers to create a duplicate version, a mirror of reality. And this second version is by necessity smaller in volume and less interconnected than the first version. The making of legibility narrows existing social complexity into a smaller set of possibilities. Compared to the plantation that is legible in Scott's sense, the jungle is more complex, at least for the first time visitor or observer. Similarly, everything that is not legible in Scott's sense, for instance, nomadism, hunting and gathering, tacit knowledge, presents complex social challenges. But it's precisely all these features that are very common in so-called simple societies, where there's little by way of state legibility. State legibility rests on techniques, on tools, on symbols that simplify social challenges. Tool use does that by creating path dependencies that André Leroy-Gourhan, excuse my French, has described as a chaîne opératoire. A tool enables a chain of actions. Basically, you can do certain things better and more efficiently while other possibilities are excluded. Symbolization essentially means to limit the field of possible connections to certain targets. A symbol can stand for many things, but it cannot stand for everything. Tools and symbols, therefore, favor certain uses and responses and enable specific procedures of action. And in this sense, they simplify social complexity. Simplicity, however, depends on the perspective. A new tool facilitates and simplifies challenges for the user, but seen from the outside, adding a new tool, well, adds a new tool. Having an additional tool then that can be used in many ways and that can mean many things depending on context entangles one more element to the system. And thus, while simplifying social challenges on one level, they add complexity on other levels. It's possible to distinguish between these two effects of simplification and complexification. And the concepts I want to propose for these are commensuration and complicity. The social is simplified when it is split up into units, that is, under commensuration. The social becomes more complex when different elements correspond to each other by way of complicity. Now, that's enough theory. Enough speculation about possible complexities. The second part of my lecture is about complexity out there. That is what we can say about actually existing complexities. For instance, the complexity of peasant life in China. That was, in fact, the main topic of my PhD. And the central question of my PhD proposal was, what does it mean to be a peasant? Soon after I began fieldwork in 2005, I had to revise the question because the answer was obvious. No one wants to be a peasant. Everyone I met in Beijing and in Anhui and in Hubei described peasant life as a thing of the past. And of course, exactly at that time, millions of Chinese peasants were leaving the countryside and working in the city. I eventually settled in a village in the Enshe district of Hubei province, and there I tried to understand everyday life, family, work, and local politics. What really struck me was the difference between local practice and official discourse, especially when it came to things that seemed crucially important in local society, for instance, family ritual or gambling. While these things were fairly common in the village, they were also quite sensitive in official discourse. They were feudal superstition, backwards custom. Feng Shui, the Chinese art of geomancy, is typical in this regard. My supervisor, Stefan Feuchtwang, in fact, had written a whole book about it, an anthropological analysis of Chinese geomancy, which first came out in 1974, which I had duly read before I started fieldwork. But when I asked my neighbors in the village in Enshe, their first reaction was always along the lines, well, feng shui, that's kind of backwards superstition. You won't find anything of that here. Maybe if you go high up the mountains, some remote places, you can find. But after weeks and months in the same village, I realized that every family was indeed inviting ritual experts to advise on the feng shui of their new houses or on the siting of tombs. And when I asked now about feng shui, the reactions were quite different, more of the kind, well, you know. Because it was impossible to deny what we all knew together, that feng shui was actually quite important locally. This kind of gap between the ways people present themselves to strangers and what matters locally, I came to describe as complicity. A crucial inspiration was Michael Hertzfeld's idea of cultural intimacy, which he developed first in Crete. The example was that of sheep stealing among Highlanders, who don't admit to outsiders they are involved, knowing quite well that sheep stealing is part of the negative image these outsiders have of the same Highlanders. What I was trying to understand in China, things such as feng shui, were quite similar. The tension between vernacular and state language, between local understanding and public performance, produced cultural intimacy. It did so via communicative strategies, including embarrassment, cynicism, and irony. And I thought these processes were best captured by the concept of complicity, because complicity wasn't just there, it was performed all the time. It's the dirty laundry of other people, those things that usually are not said in public, and hence writing about it is uncomfortable and unsettling. When I began to do so, it must have been about half a year after I had returned from China, I had a recurrent dream. I was at home, the Huam, beim Zug in the Zimmerau. That is, I was in the house where I had grown up in the Bavarian Alps, not far from the Austrian border. I left and walked up the slopes over the mountains and down the valleys, south, entering Austria. I maybe got as far as Südtirol, foreign territory and old houses. As I approached those buildings and saw the faces of strangers, I wondered maybe I was in one of the remote villages of Bajau in Enschede. I went to the walls and looked through the windows into the house, observing the privacy of those strangers, their kitchens and bathrooms and bedrooms, and then I continued my journey into dense forest. Finally, I reached a clearing, a grassy mountain meadow, and there was a group of people sitting around a table. A friendly voice said, "Hans, don't you want to tell us what you discovered in the Chinese farmhouses?" It was Michael Scott. Next to him, next to him, Charles Stafford, Laura Baer, the LSE anthropologists at their Friday seminar. I was horrified. I had betrayed everyone. My family in Bavaria, the people I lived with in Bajau, and the LSE anthropologists too. Not only had I failed to meet their expectations, I had actively misled and deceived them. An impersonator, pretending I was the Su Kanzi in one place, Shi Han in another, or simply Hans in the third one. I had become a monstrous shapeshifter, and I was ashamed. Becoming an accomplice requires not just to betray others, but also to betray oneself. It implies to say something and do something else, or to do something and add a meta comment, "I didn't mean it." Those kinds of internal contradictions, however, can be very powerful in entangling things and binding people together. In other words, creating complicity increases social complexity. At the risk of sounding very abstract, here's a concrete example. In rural China today, many things are not just done for themselves, but always accompanied by a meta comment on Chinese modernity. For instance, it's not "we are doing ancestor worship now," but it's "we are doing this even though it's actually backward and feudal." And that's why all the things that are potentially backward and feudal require a degree of indirection. The complicity that arises in this way is fundamentally linked to the institutions of the nation state. In schools, at party events, on television, and on social media, the people of Hubei learn the meta discourses of Chinese modernity, which diametrically contradict their everyday practice. Nation states simplify social complexity. They do so, among other things, through the essentialist description of local communities as the antithesis of modernity, and through standardization of language and behavior. What is expressed in the standard language of the nation state is impoverished when compared with local dialect. It is context independent, disentangled from local situation, and in its simplicity, it is accessible and practical. It's similar with other features of official discourse and nation state culture. They simplify complexity so as to enable communication between strangers. But as these simplifications include distortions and misrepresentations, people need to develop strategies to concretize and localize, including techniques of indirectness, obliqueness, and subtlety. That is communities of complicity, which is the title of my book. The same process appears distinctly when we compare such constellations with other situations where nation-state institutions are absent or relatively weak. This is precisely the case in the de facto government of the Wa army in northeastern Myanmar. Hoping to escape the simplifications of the Chinese state, I traveled to the China-Burma border, where I found complexities of a different kind. Here, the United Wa State Army rules over two patches of land on the borders of Myanmar with China and Thailand. Since 2014, I've spent almost 2 years there doing fieldwork, and most of the time in a village in the Wa State on the Burmese side of the border. The people who call themselves Barok and are known by others as Wa are typical Somians, that is, inhabitants of the Southeast Asian highlands, where no permanent state rule was ever established. And indeed, in the Wa areas, the Wa remained outside the reach of neighboring states until the 1950s on the Chinese side and the 1970s on the Burmese side, when the guerrilla army of the Communist Party of Burma established the first local government, 1971. Until then, Wa communities had lived autonomously. But today, in the Wa state, ethnic Wa command the strongest non-state army in Myanmar and govern a population of about 500,000. How did this happen? In an obvious way, state formation took place in the army here, and it led to a fundamental separation between villagers and soldiers, and a great divide between ordinary people and the army elite. These elites today exercise sovereignty, even though there's no effective government bureaucracy. Sovereignty is based on a system of personal relation, of patronage networks, on the one hand, but also new relations of anonymity on the other. These relations combine capture and care. And in fact, the sovereign power of the state rests precisely on that combination of capture and care. In concrete terms, this plays out in the typical careers of child soldiers between their home villages and the barracks or the mansions of commanders. So children are captured and taken to the barracks, that is, they are forcibly recruited into the Wa army. Once they end up in the barracks or in the commander's mansion, they're supposed to be cared for, but often they're not.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Since the Wa state has few bureaucratic resources at its disposal, these actions of violence and care remain complex throughout, because they must always be renegotiated. Rather than actual paperwork, the negotiations are based on a kind of alternative legibility, a legibility created in personal relations. My emphasis on this form of alternative state legibility is in part countering the lasting image of the Wa as an egalitarian group. The term has often been used by anthropologists, including the foremost ethnographer of Wa society, Magnus Fiskesjö. So they call them egalitarians. Everyday life in the Wa state today, however, is definitely not egalitarian. Indeed, it's militarized. It's extremely hierarchical, both in the village and in the capital. Superiors always order others around. So what happened to egalitarianism here? I came to explore these issues together with my partner, Natalia Huitron, who deals with similar questions among the Shuar of Ecuadorian Amazonia, also once known as egalitarians, even though they really did not appear to be very egalitarian when Natalia was doing fieldwork there. This led us to revise the anthropological concept of egalitarianism. Most basically, egalitarianism, as the promotion of equality, requires some form of commensuration, the establishment of an equal standard. Now, we examined anthropological literature on egalitarian societies, as well as our own fieldwork experiences, in regard to actual practices of leveling, or what we came to call commensuration, more generally. And such commensuration is often experienced negatively, as a form of violence. This is one of the main ideas of a collection we edited together with Florian Mühlfried, which is entitled Nightmare Egalitarianism and will appear as a special issue of the JRAI in a few weeks. My article in that volume deals with commensuration in Wa history, and specifically in kinship exchanges. As mentioned before, everyday life in the Wa state today is anything but egalitarian. And I doubt whether Wa sociality was ever truly egalitarian in the past either. What helped me to make sense of the conundrum is this modified notion of commensuration. What mattered in kinship and sacrifice in the past was relative commensuration. That is a kind of measuring that remained ephemeral, indexical, relational, tied into relations. Only in the 20th century, after the influx of foreign armies, and in parallel with guerrilla movements and the state-building efforts of the Y elites, did absolute standards arrive. Concretely, this meant more numbers and scales. I mean, literally. People increasingly were confronted with wages, fines, prices, and lists. So absolute measures. And even though paperwork is mostly irrelevant for the crucial decisions of recruitment, lists are often produced. For instance, for the obligatory communal labor on government plantation, such as the one that I mentioned at the beginning. And here's the headman writing a list, a headcount of the people who came to work. Such lists can be ignored, and often they are ignored. But the simple existence of this absolute measure makes a difference. For instance, you can denounce shirkers and refer to the list of people who came to work the other day. And that's exactly what happens in corvée labor for the government, such as the planting of tree seedlings for a commander on the picture. In such forced labor arrangements, people frequently speculate about the reasons and intentions of others. Why did he not come today? Something they never do in ordinary work parties with neighbors, where no lists are ever produced. Hence the government of opacity, the opacity of others, that you can't look into someone else's brain, that government correlates with the type of commensuration in place. In other words, addressing the complexity of other people's intentions, in this case at least, is conditional on the simplicity of the list. I don't think it makes sense to understand why history in the 20th century as the transition from an egalitarian society to a hierarchical society. I'm much more sympathetic to the idea that the Wa state today is simple when compared to the complexity of Wa communities in the past. But even putting it like that is overly simplistic. Actually, what I suggest is the case is a social unfolding that combines simplification and complexification, depending on how you look at it. Local practices of commensuration, say what people do with these lists, embody the tacit knowledge and skill that keeps the social twisting and turning. I came to think about these problems when doing fieldwork in the Wa state, far away from the large cities of China. But actually, people have had similar thoughts in the megacities of the coast. In fact, it seems to me that Rob Weller and Ke Pingwu have described exactly the same thing in the radically transformed urban landscape of Suzhou. Their question is, what happened to folk religion when urban space is bulldozed over and replaced with grid-line structures and people are resettled in high-rises? Weller and Wu's answer in this article is that there are many different space-times or chronotopes here. So, for instance, the space-time of Buddhism and the space-time of Taoism, of tradition and of modernity. And those space-times or chronotopes are not neatly separated, but they constantly fold and unfold like a piece of origami. In local temples, some people want to standardize the gods, while others set up their kind of non-standard gods, such as Taoists who wear glasses. Right, that's non-standard for Taoist gods, as far as I understand. Weller and Wu describe how various space-times fold into each other and thus make the distant near separate inside from the outside and interweave. In their article, Weller and Wu are quite explicit about what they call the Latinate richness of folding. That is, all the many words that share the Latin roots plicare, folding, and plectare, braiding. Complications, complicities, implications, explications, replications, supplications, replies, pleats, and plats. Simple and complex belong here too. All of them go back to the same Proto-Indo-European root, plec, which is to plait, weave, braid. Hence, if complex is that which is woven together many times, or the manifold, then simple is that which is woven only once with itself, the unifold. I have said before that a graphic inscription is always a duplication of reality. That is, it's another fold, another step in the origami that represents and symbolizes something else. That is, it's both a fold more and a fold less. Legibility both simplifies the world out there and adds complexity to it. The same happens when anthropologists write about the world. They can only ever capture a minor part. They simplify. Yet doing so, by necessity, they also add complexity to the world. Take, for instance, a situation like the one I started off with. Wa villagers being forced to transplant tree seedlings on the fields of a commander. We usually use words such as jungle and plantation to describe that. Doing so, we radically fold the complexity of the world into doodles and diagrams, such as this one. Concepts are always simplifications that need to be woven into other concepts. You might, for instance, think about the jungle and the plantation in relation to relations, perspectives, numbers, and so on. Actually, it's not me who did that. It was Ludovic Coupé. To be precise, he did this at a meeting we had in Cambridge, trying to explain to a group of colleagues, including Natalia Buitron, Carlos Fausto, Matei Candea, and myself, what distinguished gardens from plantations. Inevitably, those discussions got very complex. I'm only referencing them here to illustrate what I mean when I say that thinking about complexity inevitably folds reality. And the result is both more simple and more complex than what was there before. A concept can cut through the forest of things and open a clearing. It also adds another tree, or at least another branch, to the entanglement. Anthropologists typically emphasize either aspect. For instance, early British social anthropology wanted to simplify and identify the structure and function of society. Contemporary anthropologists usually want to complexify. But social anthropologists haven't solved the double bind yet of how to do both at the same time. And therefore, we would do well to explicate our assumptions about complexity and simplicity. Simplicity exists in unambiguous rules, lines, and diagrams. But most of the world exists outside those simplicities. Acting, thinking, and writing inevitably deal with complexity and simplicity because simplicity and complexity always come together. They're tied into an envelope. How they evolve depends on the perspective and the frame of attention. With the concepts of complicity and commensuration, we can push the envelope further. Complicity ties complex processes through shared implicit understandings. And that was the kind of interaction that Cohen and Stewart tried to get at with their image of two hands moving up as if catching an invisible rope. Commensuration, on the other hand, means to compartmentalize, that is, to superimpose units and scales onto complexity. Commensuration, that is, comparison by unit and scale, creates new simplicity. Whereas complicity, that is, the creation of shared implicit understandings, increases complexity. Now that's a tongue twister. Commensuration increases simplicity, and complicity increases complexity. I hope I have convinced you that the social is complex, but maybe you didn't need convincing. It's fairly uncontroversial to say that, especially amongst anthropologists. I've started this whole lecture by saying that anthropologists often ask for complexity and denounce complicity. I'm very sympathetic to both positions. Anthropologists should indeed try to capture complexity, and they should also reflect on how their scholarship is implicated in privilege and oppression. but I don't think that complicity is necessarily a bad thing. And neither is complexity necessarily a good thing. Complexity is neither good or bad. It's just there. It's just a thing. It is constantly unfolding, an entanglement, like an origami or a Möbius strip or a twisted plait. The metaphor doesn't matter, but it matters that there's system to it. It is possible to understand some of it, partially, sometimes, just like it is possible to see complexity from different perspectives. And some of them might appear actually quite simple. Thank you.
Thank you, Hans, for such a wonderful, wide-ranging, challenging, stimulating lecture. Somehow I feel a sense of complicity sitting up here with you. You know, we have time, I think, for a couple of questions. Perhaps I'll ask a question, perhaps a simple question, and then take several questions from the floor and perhaps online as well. Well, I think it's often said that in contrast to our colleagues in other social sciences who grapple with the complexities of human experience by reducing those complexities to large data sets or, you know, statistical models, anthropologists seek to reveal and describe the full complexities of the social world. I mean, that's precisely what distinguishes our discipline, and it's the method of ethnography from, you know, these other approaches. So with that in mind, I'd like to ask you a question that I think might go to the heart of tonight's lecture, at least as I understand it. Shouldn't we, as anthropologists, try to do justice to the complexity of the social world?
Yes, sure. I mean, we should. I mean, it's the world is complex. It's complex. The social is complex. No denying it. The way I was thinking about it is just like trying to think about it the other way around, how compared to how we usually use the terms. For instance, in the natural sciences, they don't have a problem with reductivism or cumulative research. Well, someone does research, you learn about it, then you add to it, it's more. And anthropology, it's nothing of the sort because it's so complex, and anthropologists always ask for more complexity, more nuance. So kind of simplicity has a bad name. And that's what I want to criticize. Saying in anthropology, we should also appreciate simplicity sometimes. I mean, in a way, as I try to say, whether we want it or not, we always do that, because any writing or any kind of thinking can never capture everything that's out there. That would be like making a map of the world that is just as big as the world, and then you don't have a map anymore. So it's necessarily by necessity reducing some of the complexity out there. We're doing this by default, and what I think is it would be better for anthropology to be more explicit about that, rather than just thinking that complexity is a good thing.
Great, thank you. Just to open things up to take questions from the floor. Yes, the lady in row three. Three seats in, I think. If you just wait for the microphone,
yes.
And maybe if you could introduce yourself.
Hi, I am Lucia Michelutti, and great lecture, Hans, really love it. I can help but not ask something about complicity and extortion, and we are continuously told that we live in a kind of racket society, or enmeshed in racket-like exchanges, and think about the Epstein case, or a lot of sovereign power now use racket tactics. And so it strikes me that in a way, I mean, what this kind of, we can call it conspiracy theories, you know, about of living in a mafia state may be very complex because in a way you need the complicity of everybody, of the accomplice. But on the other hand, it's very simple because racket logics are very simple. So it's just a comment, but I think that quite resonates, you know, with this type of kind of logics.
Yeah, totally. I mean, when you, for instance, the Epstein files, or like the mafia state, like in your own work, racket society in India, in a way, it's very simple. I mean, this is not like a conspiracy. The conspiracy is true. They all knew each other. It's only about power, sex, and money. Everyone, like, I just saw all the pictures behind there of the people who spoke here. I mean, a third of them were in the Epstein files. But so it's like the conspiracy is true, and that's very simple. There's no so I send you to say, isn't that the I'm saying complicity creates complexity, but here we have like this public complicity that is actually very simple. Well, I would answer it's because this is not about complicity anymore. Now that we can all check on our internet, everyone who is mentioned in the files, it's about accountability. I mean, the kind of relation that Andrew Mountbatten might have had with Jeffrey Epstein is not one of complicity anymore now. So it's something else. And it's kind of like in my framework, this is not complicity anymore. This is no more complex. This is a like simplifying by naming it, you change it into something else.
Maybe the gentleman in the, is it the fifth row back? I'm in the center there. Yes, if you could introduce yourself.
Thank you. Thanks, I'm Di, and I'm a PhD student at the LSE Anthropology. So I want to ask a question about the individual intention for simplification. So you described that state institutions need simplification to create legibility. But oftentimes, individual bureaucrats, they create standards and criterias to hide their arbitrary and complicit decision-making process. So instead of destroying the social complexity, perhaps you could talk a little bit about individual different individual intention behind, perhaps to hide their complicity.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to ask about individual intentions, like of bureaucrats, because the bureaucrat who kind of simplifies the world or creates a Potemkin village in China, does a face project, like a Mianzigongzhang. In my scheme, they're kind of commensurating, they're creating legibility, but also by doing that, all that fakery, all that stuff, they're creating something that is more complex. It's in both, it's part of both movements of simplification and complexification. It's also important to distinguish between what's happening locally and what's happening kind of analytically, like elevated from that. So whatever the individual bureaucrat does and thinks to understand a problem, it might make things simpler for him, like he can rationalize, but for the whole system, it makes it more complex. And so that is another very important thing that I wanted to emphasize, that simplicity and complexity always depend on the perspective. But what might be simple for one is complex to the other. And that depends on which way you look at it.
Our colleague Deborah James has been monitoring the online questions, I think. Thank you.
Just one question here, and that is, you didn't say very much about the complicity when it came to the Wa state, but more about the complexity. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, of course, in Hubei, I talked about complicity, and in the Wa state, I talked about commensuration, and that was really how I came to think about these issues. But now, every time I tried to think about complicity in the Wa state, it was kind of pointless, because all these things that I found are very sensitive and tricky in the Chinese countryside, like talk about feng shui, talk about weddings and funerals, talk about state culture, in the Wa state, that wasn't a problem at all. People were totally happy to tell me all the kind of feudal superstition they did. That just wasn't a problem. The complicities that are there, they're complicities of a very different kind. And actually, I would say that complicity, like in China, is really conditional on nation-state institutions, right? These people who go to school for such a long time and constantly are kind of indoctrinated by official discourse, they have very strong moral guidelines of how to think about these issues. So there's a contradiction here. Whereas in the Wa state, people don't go to school, and so there's no contradiction. It's a very different kind of complicity. Also thinking about our complicity as anthropologists, as professors, I think it's always different. Like asking about complicity is an empirical question. What people share, the kind of intimate knowledge, is of course very different. And I think that's an important point to make when we think about writings on complicity in anthropology, because often people write about it as if it goes without saying that we share the same complicity, like our involvement in privilege and in capitalism, in oppression, in colonialism. But of course, those implicit knowledges are very different for Wa villagers or Chinese peasants. I mean, when I became professor at LSE, many people congratulated and said, congratulations. There was one senior colleague who said, welcome to the dark side. It's another kind of complicity, I suppose. But maybe I shouldn't talk more about.
Well, we're a little bit over time, so I think we should finish. Everyone deserves a drink, especially Hans. So we can continue the conversation upstairs on the fifth floor over refreshments. If you can take the stairs up, please take the stairs and leave the lift to people who can't manage the stairs. So join me once again in congratulating Hans on such a marvelous lecture.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.